The following podcast contains explicit materials. It's Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The 19 children and two teachers dead mark the Uvalde, Texas school shooting as tied for the eighth most deadly in U.S. history. An AR-15 or similar semi-automatic long gun was used. This means that of the 10 deadliest mass shootings in the last 30 years, 9 have featured an AR-15 or similar weapon.
Yesterday's shooter did use an AR-15 style rifle.
We once again have seen the .223 caliber AR-15 style firearm being used.
Used an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle.
The shooter bought an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle.
I've made my case for banning the AR-15, at least banning new production, which could have helped in this case. And I know that that case isn't going anywhere politically, but I think it bears repeating with some new information priced in. I also hope the case may fall upon the ears of an AR-15 owner. I know there are some in my audience or just an opponent of banning the weapon, and my arguments might strike them as a more reasonable version of the arguments they hear. But that doesn't really matter because this policy recommendation, A, just simply won't happen, but also B, won't happen because I have convinced AR-15 enthusiasts to become unenthused or because any minds are likely to change. For anything to be done, voters need to prioritize it as an issue at the national level. And for many reasons, including history, I do not think that will happen. But if it does, here's what makes the AR-15 and similar weapons so highly correlative to mass casualty events. One, cavitation. Cavitation is the creation of a cavity within the body's organs. The amount of force generated by any round of a weapon fired is determined by barrel length, speed generated, and the size of the round. Compared to other rifles, the AR-15 is in fact not especially deadly, not especially prone to cause organ damage. You might hear gun enthusiasts tell you that the Winchester, the gun that settled the West, would cause a much bigger hole and much more damage if it hit an organ. That's all true. But what the AR-15 rifle is a rifle. And rifles, all rifles, are much more likely to kill than handguns. Writing in The Atlantic, Heather Scher, who's a radiologist, treated gunshot victims after Parkland. She also treats gunshot victims normally from handgun shootings. She writes, handgun injuries to the liver are generally survivable unless the bullet hits the main blood supply to the liver. An AR-15 bullet wound to the middle of the liver would cause so much bleeding that the patient would likely never make it to the trauma center to receive our care. You'll typically hear a story where an assailant attacks a group with a handgun. This isn't the normal gun violence of someone trying to shoot one other person. I'm talking about a would-be mass shooting, but the weapon is a handgun. And typical in those cases, and there are exceptions, one or two people are killed. Those were the people the shooter was aiming to kill or shot at first. And then, after that, many people are injured. On the New York subway, 10 people were shot by a handgun. No one died. I have never heard of an AR-15 attack where 10 people were shot with no deaths. The 22 round is not especially big. You'll hear gun enthusiasts, users of the AR-15 say, I wouldn't even use it for big game, but a lot of people do. And because of the barrel length and propulsive force, the deadliness of that round is so much worse than a handgun. Brings me to point number two, magazine size. Rifles are deadly. This is what I've spent some time just trying to tell you. But handguns contain more rounds. The magazines do. A handgun might come with, you know, a Glock. They might sell a 22-round magazine as the standard. The standard magazine for an AR-15 is 30 rounds. Now, some states, California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, Vermont, Colorado, and some counties in Illinois, ban the sale of more than 10 rounds in a magazine. But because of the ease of loading those rounds, those bullets, into the chamber again and again and again and again, shooters are able to cause more damage than they would with another type of rifle. Now, it is true that magazines, you know, multiple rounds that could load at once, are available for all types of rifles, bolt, lever, break. That's true. But they hold many fewer rounds than the typical AR-15 or even the modified as mandated by law AR-15 rounds that are sold in the states that I've already said. Number three, attraction. The first two reasons that I gave you blame the tool for the terror it inflicts because of things like exit velocity and the number of rounds, empirical reasons. The third biggest reason to ban these weapons is how the weapon plays into the fantasy of shooters. The word that I've used in the past is totemic. When you're talking about acts that have some element of derangement involved, fantasies around a specific type of weapon take hold. The AR-15 represents to the next mass murderer all those past mass murderers. Several shooters post-Columbine specifically talked about drawing inspiration from those two killers. We see the cut-and-paste manifesto from earlier screeds being put out there by current shooters. The type of gun is exciting to these shooters. Many other arguments rest on the idea that if you take away the type of weapon, they'll still be able to create the carnage. They'll still pick up another type of gun and shoot people. Yes, just not at this scale and doing damage to this degree. This, the attraction argument, rests on the theory that robbing would-be shooters of this key prop in the performance they're about to engage in can lessen the overall desire to commit the act. I firmly believe that to be the case. Four, the fourth reason to ban the AR-15 is because of the huge societal disruption mass murders and mass shootings have. Mass murders lodge themselves in our consciousness and they disturb us disproportionately. I'm saying all this as an answer to the question or the valid critique that you might hear that a ban on AR-15s, even if the ban were to work, wouldn't really lower the overall murder rate. It would budget maybe by 3 or 4%. The thing is, I don't see our national mood and the national conversation being hijacked and plunged into despair at Chicago's 22 gun murders so far in May, the 6 people who were shot to death in Philadelphia on Saturday. That didn't really resonate outside of Philadelphia. It was the 10 people in Buffalo and the 21 in Texas. This is a glaring example of a problem that we refuse to fix. It strikes so many Americans not as a policy problem, but as a moral failing. It shakes our foundations. Good people would not allow this to continue. We think about ourselves, so we think of our fellow countrymen as not good people. And what is public policy meant to do except to address these kind of concerns? We're very concerned with this specific type of shooting, and therefore we should do something about it. And we once did. An historic ban between 1994 and 2004 had a measurable effect on mass shootings, and that ban, the effectiveness thereof, gives lie to the common refrain that would-be shooters will find a way no matter what. Yeah, they'll find a way to shoot and kill, but not so many and not so often. The AR-15 has proven over many, many years and many, many slaughters to have been attractive, plentiful, and deadly. It is a uniquely proficient killing machine. By allowing them to circulate and to indeed proliferate, we don't just consign some of our fellow citizens to be slaughtered, we also consign ourselves to the status of people who refuse to do anything about it. On the show today, the state of Georgia voted in great number, so what about that suppression? But first, joining us once more is Admiral James Stavridis, retired 4-star. The name of his book is To Risk It All, 9 Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. And I put him through the crucible of just questioning as we talk about the Ukraine war and historical precedents of naval prowess. Admiral James Stavridis up next.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Gist listeners, do you want to hear Mike live? He will be speaking Thursday, May 26th at the Comedy Cellar as part of their Cellar Talk series. Doors open at 5:30, and as a special offer for Gist listeners, the first 6 tickets will be given for free if you email thecellartalks at gmail.com. That's thecellartalks at gmail.com. Proof of vaccination is required to attend. We hope to see you there, and feel free to stop by and say hi to Mike after the show.
We're joined once more by Admiral James Stavridis, retired 4-star, NATO Supreme Allied Commander, and, for our purposes, most recently, the author of To Risk It All, 9 Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. So I began by thinking about all the Russian generals who have died. And my thoughts, because I guess I was talking to an admiral, ran to the admirals. Are they, I wondered, as important to the Navy as generals are to the Army? So my question to Stavridis was, the reason we're told that generals are so often at the front and in harm's way in the Russian army is that their command and control structure requires them to be much more hands-on than, say, an American general would be. Is it the same with the Russian Navy?
It is not. The reason the Russian generals are going to the front and exposing themselves to fires and incredibly stupidly talking openly on cell phones, which obviously you don't have to be Tom Clancy to know, don't start talking on a cell phone or you're going to get targeted by U.S. intelligence.
Drug dealers know that.
Exactly. So why are they doing that? And the answer is not because they're brave and they want to lead from the front. They're doing that because their troops don't know what to do. They're disorganized. They don't have any leadership on the front. So the generals are forced to go forward and try and compensate by going on the battlefield and thus to lose perhaps as many as 10 generals in 2.5 months. Again, astounding. Yeah. Mike, we were in Afghanistan and Iraq for 20 years with 350,000 troops. You know how many generals we lost in combat? 0.
Yeah.
So again, 2.5 months, 10 generals on a force around 100,000 effectives, just really incompetent. Admirals, different story because ships are kind of self-contained. They come with their ammunition, they come with their propulsion, they come with their crew and their manning, they have medical facilities, they have communications. It's a package. So as an admiral, you can sit back on shore and be talking, and you're talking to a competent, unified command structure, whereas armies are, all the things I just mentioned, are all over the map, all over the battlefield. As a senior leader, you've got to kind of pull it together. It's a big advantage of being in the Navy in that regard. So admirals are not going to be going, you know, to the front lines of combat on the warships if they're smart.
So let me ask you, I know that you're a humanitarian and you take the idea of defense literally as not a euphemism. And you, of course, want this war to end with as minimizing the human costs and for Ukraine to survive as a society. However, we also know that Putin is a bad actor and could cause a lot of havoc. And it does seem the longer the war goes on, the more his capacity to do bad in the world is degraded. So do you look at it like that? Like, hey, Putin, you want to keep going? Keep going, because it will make defending our new NATO allies, our old NATO allies, and everyone else a little bit easier.
Napoleon said, never interrupt your enemy when he is in the process of making a massive strategic mistake. And I think that does apply here. However, there's a countervailing point, which is in Napoleon's time, Lord Nelson and the British didn't have nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Putin does. So I think we need to be sensible in not painting Russia entirely into a corner here. And we need to start thinking about how can this war end in a way that doesn't drag us into a larger conflict a la World War I and the guns of August in 1914. Neither side wants a big war here. Neither side wants a big war here. But the point is, we've got to sail a pretty narrow sea, Mike, between arming the Ukrainians, giving them the tools, putting diplomatic pressure on Russia, bringing NATO, bringing Finland and Sweden into NATO. I think that's a good move. It puts additional pressure on Russia. But we don't want to get on the other side of that equation. That's why I don't advocate a NATO no-fly zone. I don't advocate U.S. troops going into Ukraine. I think we need to kind of stay in the center here and think coherently about the end game so that we don't end up staggering into a larger war.
But getting them long-range guns so that they're so the Russians don't always have a six-mile advantage where they can hit the Ukrainians and correct, the Ukrainians can't hit back. So things like that are really important.
They are vital, and we have given the Ukrainians literally everything they have asked for, with one exception still under debate, is giving them fighters, advanced jet fighters. Mm-hmm. The Poles have such fighters, MiG-29s, that the Ukrainian pilots are perfectly capable of flying. The Poles have offered those. They want US F-16s in return from us. I think that's a deal that still makes a lot of sense. Other than that one item, we have given Ukraine everything that they have asked for, everything, in my view, that they need to fight the Russians to a standstill.
In the book, it struck me in the beginning, in the end, sprinkled throughout chapters, the importance of time. And now I think when people think about warfare and you think about what are the major factors, you think about materiel, you think about training, you think about bravery. But you talk about, first of all, as a commander, the ability to slow down time and really training for that. But you also talk about the effect when planning an operation, not just saying, who's my enemy? What's the objective? But what's the time frame? And I just had not thought of it that way, and it's fascinating. Let's apply that to Ukraine. What are some of the temporal insights or challenges that maybe we haven't thought of that can apply to the conflict in Ukraine?
Yeah, in the book, To Risk It All, we talk a lot about understanding that time can feel elastic, but it's actually contracting in so many situations. And for Vladimir Putin, who's taken enormous risk, as we've talked about, what's contracting is, I'll use a business term here, his burn rate. Mm-hmm. He's going through his cash. You know, General Sherman in the Civil War here in the States said, war is hell. I'll add to that and say, war is also expensive. And Putin is burning through cash. His burn rate is unsustainable. So his timeline is contracting. For Zelensky on the other side of the line, what is his burn rate is the will of his people, of whom millions and millions and millions have been pushed out of Ukraine or in refugee camps. People are separated from their families. How long will their will continue to do what they've done so far, to stay on the front lines and fight this fight? I think that Putin's burn rate is going to contract time for him much more quickly in the end than Zelensky's. And so when I put all that together, Mike, I think that Putin, over the 2 to 4, 6 months at the outside, he's got to be looking for an exit ramp here. And that may be the most dangerous moment here. And yeah, that is where we need to be thinking now about the risk that we're willing to take in terms of what can he be allowed to retain of Ukraine. And I think the answer is going to be something greater than zero.
And you know, and I know you know, the Ukrainians will be getting an infusion of $40 billion worth of weaponry, a massive infusion.
Oh,
so
yeah,
if you can picture the charts of Ukrainian capacity and also willingness to fight, it might be reaching its peak. At the same time, the Russians' willingness to fight and ability to fight might be ebbing the most.
It is both.
And I've got to wonder if what you're talking about, looking for off-ramps, if that is the goal, is it a good thing or a bad thing, a dangerous thing, that the Ukrainians will have all this material and capability in the near future?
Exactly. And it is exactly why I say that is the moment of maximum danger here. And I think that the administration is working quite hard to get the Ukrainians thinking about this so that they can lay this out. Because at the end of the day, these aren't decisions for Jim Stavridis and Mike Pesca. These are decisions the Ukrainians have to make. All we can do is put ourselves in their situation and think, what would we be willing to live with? I think at this point, if I were Ukrainian, even with all of the money and all of the help, Russia remains formidable and will be here and there on their border forever. And so are you willing to give up 10% of your nation in order to gain peace, along with security guarantees from the West? I think that's a conversation Ukrainians need to have. And if it were me in that situation, I would be thinking quite seriously about how to construct that exit, because it's an exit not only for Putin, it's an exit for Ukraine to where they can begin to rebuild their country.
Last thing I want to ask about are the two new NATO members to be new members, Finland, Sweden. So from your perspective, as a man who was once NATO Supreme Allied Commander, what was NATO's relationship with those two countries pre-joining NATO?
Could not have been closer. They were not formal NATO members, obviously, but they were strong partners. They participated operationally alongside NATO troops. Under my command in Afghanistan were 150,000 troops, including significant troops from both Sweden and Finland. They also participated in operations in the Balkans. Sweden also flew in the no-fly zone over Libya in the war in Libya. So I know these militaries well. They've served under my command. They are professional, competent, ruthless warfighters when they need to be. And by the way, they're an interesting matched pair as follows. Finland is a land power. You would be too if you had an 800-mile border with Russia. They have a million people they can mobilize. All have had their mandatory conscription, all do annual refreshers, a million person army potentially with the weapons to arm it. That's a formidable land force. Sweden, on the other hand, high tech. You know, if you can make a Volvo, you can make a pretty good fighter jet. They make something called a Gripen, which is as good as a U.S. Hornet, one of our top fighters. They make marvelous diesel submarines. As a pair, you've got technology, superb quality and warfighting systems on the Swedish side, true grit, land power on the Finnish side. If you want to be inspired, by the way, and learn a little history that informs your thinking on Ukraine, Google the Winter War, Finland, 1939. Finland, about the size of Ukraine, fought the Soviet army under Joseph Stalin to a standstill. Here's a definitive point. However, at the end of the day, Finland gave up 10% of its land to Russia for a security pledge, which was backed by the West. Could that be a solution in Ukraine? Worth having that conversation. History never repeats itself precisely, but it informs us. And this is a good example of that.
So Sweden wasn't in NATO because their people didn't want to be in NATO. 80% of the population was against it. Now something like 80% of the population is for it. NATO is a collection of democracies. Let's put an asterisk next to Turkey. But in general, NATO was a collection of states that were democracies and wanted to be in NATO. And now Finland and Sweden fit that bill. However, there is another argument, and I think a decent enough one to consider, and it's that this could be a provocation. I mean, when you were Supreme Allied Commander, I'm sure if these two countries or others with their qualifications had raised their hands and said, we want in, you would say, of course, we welcome you in. This will strengthen the alliance. But can you allay the concerns of someone who says putting a couple of states like this, Finland especially, right up against the border of Russia. It could be a provocation, and that is at least enough to seriously ponder because it makes us nervous. What do you think?
I think it is worth the risk. There is some risk, but I'll give you 3 points. First, it's Putin who's launched this invasion. It's Putin who has attacked not only Ukraine twice, but Georgia. He seeks to dominate all the nations around the periphery of Russia. So it's Putin who's the aggressor here. And history, again, tells us backing up in front of an aggressor, generally not a good way to go. Point two, Russia has broken its lance, if you will, in Ukraine. Militarily, they have no serious options. They're not going to attack Finland. They're not going to attack Sweden. They're getting their clocks cleaned in many cases by Ukraine. So I think it's highly unlikely that they will take this on. And Exhibit A, by the way, would be that Putin, over the last couple of days, after some initial fussing about it, Putin has said, well, it's not really a big deal if Finland and Sweden join NATO. He's saying that because he has no options. And, you know, to quote Clint Eastwood, a man's got to know his limitations. Putin has hit his limitations. He knows it. He doesn't have any serious play here. And then third and finally, bringing them in fits with the NATO treaty, the organization, the ethos of the organization. If you want to spend only 5 to 7 minutes learning about this, Google NATO treaty and read it. It's only got 32 sentences in it, including the famous Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all. Another article lays out the case on membership, says any nation that is a democracy in a position to further the capabilities of the alliance in the North Atlantic area, that's Europe and North America, should be considered for membership.
Yeah, these are perfect candidates.
They're perfect candidates.
They're better democracies, right now, according to the world rankings, than the United States is.
Indeed they are. They're among the happiest people on the earth. By the way, yes. Did you know this? Swedes and Finns also drink more coffee per capita than any other countries in the world.
Right, so eternal vigilance.
Eternal vigilance. They're awake all night. They're a great pair. I'll tell you, we ought to grab them while we can. And by the way, I'm bummed out. The other day I saw that the NATO Salesman of the Year award went to Vladimir Putin.
Uh-huh.
He's selling, you know, NATO tickets faster than anybody could have imagined.
With his flagship all destroyed, he had to pivot to other revenue streams, I guess.
Exactly.
Creative destruction? I don't know.
There you go.
The name of the book is To Risk It All, 9 Conflicts and the Crucible of Decision. It is written by Admiral James Stavridis. As always, a pleasure.
Thanks so much, Mike. Great to be with you.
We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
And now the spiel. Yesterday, 1.2 million people voted in the Republican primary for governor of Georgia. 1.2 million. That's more than double the turnout of the 2018 runoff election that, like last night, resulted in a Brian Kemp win. Of course, in 2018, Brian Kemp was endorsed by Donald Trump, which helped him. This time, he was assailed by Donald Trump, which seems not to have hurt. But I'm actually more interested in what super high turnout means. Last night, 700,000 votes were registered in support of incumbent Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock in a primary with no serious challenger. Compared to 2016, it was double the number of voters who came out, and the 2016 primary was actually competitive. So does this mean that all the talk of voter suppression in Georgia was exaggerated? No one seemed suppressed. They seemed excited. That is, in fact, the thesis of certain conservative outlets, like the Washington Examiner, in an article by that outlet's editor-in-chief. It is argued, quote, Brian Kemp as governor followed up with the 2021 Georgia Election Integrity Act, which increased opportunities for early voting while taking steps to make voter fraud more difficult. Biden disinterred Jim Crow to express his characteristically overblown outrage. And the Brennan Center for Social Justice wrote, quote, given the dynamics of the 2020 election, the restrictions to voting by mail seem especially likely to hurt black voters. But then, the Examiner continues, but a funny thing happened on the way to Election Day. Early primary voting has surged in Georgia to some 900,000 ballots, which is more than 168% higher than in 2020. Some suppression effort. Okay, me now. That comparison of early ballots to early ballots is not the total vote, but as I demonstrated, that surge too. There are many ways to get to the point that voting was certainly not suppressed. But what's odd to me is that the conservative press is touting how very non-suppressive their favored election laws are, rather than advising Republican politicians that their tactics are failing. The editorials they write shouldn't be, hey, Democrats, shove your claims of suppression. Their argument should be, ahem, Republicans, ever hear of the Streisand effect? And that's entirely what's happening. It happened in Georgia. It happened in North Carolina. The actual real-world consequence of the laws that seek to curtail widespread access to the ballot box is that you activate those voters who would otherwise be discouraged. Now, if this debate were scored on the criteria, who's being perfectly honest and who's exaggerating, both sides would lose. Yes, Republicans shrank the number of drop boxes for absentee ballots in Atlanta from 111 to 23. But there are still 23 drop boxes in Atlanta. That's 23 more than we have in noted non-Republican-dominated New York City. The motivation of shrinking the number of drop boxes wasn't pure, except in the sense of pure partisan gain. The stated motivation was fear of a non-existent tampering or as-yet-to-be-executed fraud. But the real-life effect was Atlanta voters were simply not as convenienced as they might have been. But they were still given plenty of ways to vote, which they did in record number. Joe Biden called Georgia's new election law Jim Crow 2.0. He also listed three ways he could fight these suppressive laws. One was passing federal legislation. Two was educating the American public. And he actually never got to three in this answer I'm going to play. Instead, he embellished the educating the American public component with this description.
And so I'm convinced that we'll be able to stop this because it is the most pernicious thing. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. I mean, this is gigantic what they're trying to do, and it cannot be sustained.
Jim Eagle is kind of a nonsense phrase and to gleeful conservatives representative of a nonsense argument. But I go back to my original framing of the terms of the debate. If you're a Republican, what world do you prefer? That you have a bunch of data to prove that your efforts to suppress the vote actually increased Democratic turnout? Or would you rather live in a world that didn't have increased Democratic turnout? Would you, Republicans, rather win the debate? Or maybe you should realize it's actually not a debate. It's a political tactic, and Republicans are failing at it. I guess some Republican political strategists might think like this, that they're betting that the Democratic response of using the label voter suppression, and as I've demonstrated or cited, has often, almost always been followed by voters not being suppressed at all, that after a while, that will yield diminishing returns, and the actual suppression might rear its ugly head. Or maybe political strategists think, oh, well, at least we get to keep playing clips of Democrats warning about suppression that actually winds up in a Democratic eruption. The rival party is playing wolf. That can't be good for them. Yeah, except for all the elections they're winning. It seems a poor justification for a failed tactic. Yesterday was the primary in Georgia and Texas, another state that has dabbled with suppressive policies. So far, Republicans haven't actually lost to Democrats. Let's see if they need that occurrence to convince themselves to change course. I would advise that Republicans just endorse the drop box, or else pay at the ballot box, but with a really strong piece of data to point to as your opponent gives his victory speech. And that's it for today's show. The Gist is assistant produced by Corey Wara, senior produced by Joel Patterson, and the Command Master Chief of Joint Interagency Task Force South for Peachfish Productions is Michelle Pesca. The Gist is also produced in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oomperoo, jeeperoo, dooperoo. Goodbye, David Perdue, and thanks for listening.